This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A somewhat fictionalized version of Reuben Hurricane Carter's life is now showing in movie theaters, starring Denzel Washington. With me is Carter himself and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Carter. Hirsch is a former staff writer for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. In 1966, when Carter was a top contender for the middleweight boxing crown, he and a friend were arrested for a triple murder in a bar in Paterson, New Jersey. They maintained their innocence but were convicted. Carter was sentenced to life. In 1976, the New Jersey State Supreme Court overturned his conviction on grounds that the prosecutors withheld material evidence from the defense. But Carter was reconvicted in a second trial later the same year. His conviction was overturned by a federal judge in 1985. Now Carter is the executive director of the Canadian-based Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. I asked Carter to describe the night he was arrested.
I was on my way home, and John Artis, the young man, was on his way home, and I was passing in his direction. And he asked me for a lift home. And as we were going home and was stopped at a red light, waiting for the traffic light to change, a police car pulled up alongside of us. And when this police car pulled up alongside of us, other police cars converged on the scene. And we were transported down through the cities of Paterson, New Jersey, until we arrived at a place where there were 75 to 100 people milling in the streets around this tavern called Lafayette Bar and Grill, which we had never known existed before. And we were taken out of the car, brought to the hospital, where one of the people who had been shot in this bar was still alive and still conscious, and he had been shot himself. And we were placed in front of this man and asked if we were the ones who shot him. The man looked at us, studied us, and said, "No, these are not the people who shot me." And we were then taken to the police station, held for 17 hours, given lie detector tests, passed the lie detector test, and finally, 17 hours later, we were released. We find out then that four people had been shot in the Lafayette Bar and Grill by two other people whose descriptions were two tall, light-skinned men, 5'11 to 6 feet tall, weighing 170 to 190 pounds, with pencil-thin mustaches. And from that moment on, we went to court, fearing for our lives, being tried for the death penalty of these murders, and being tried by no evidence existed at all. All the evidence that existed, there was no police weapons. There was any. You see, that's the extent to which I know about anything else that happened on June 17th, 1966. That's it.
James Hirsch, from your reading of the record, what do you think convinced the jury that Carter was actually guilty?
Well, basically, the state pinned its case on the eyewitness testimony of two petty criminals and admitted liars who were in the vicinity of the crime scene that night. They were in the midst of breaking into a warehouse. And these two individuals testified at the trial that they saw Reuben Carter and John Artis fleeing from the crime scene. Only later, after the trial, was it revealed that they gave their testimony in exchange for promises of leniency from the prosecutors. And ultimately, both witnesses recanted their testimony and acknowledged that they had perjured themselves.
Reuben Carter, did you feel that the police were out to get you?
Oh, I didn't feel the police were out to get me. I knew the police were out to get me, and they were out to get a lot of different people at that time. It just so happened that Paterson, New Jersey was my hometown. It just so happened that I was the number one contender of the world. I was the hometown celebrity. Some people didn't like that. I lived in the suburbs. I was making over $100,000 a year. I had custom-made cars. I had custom-made clothes. I had horses up on the mountain. I had yachts in the in the ocean. I was at the peak of my career, married, beautiful three-year-old daughter. There were a lot of people in Paterson who didn't like that, who didn't like the fact. And plus, I was arrogant. No question about it.
Had said things that had really inflamed, I think, the police.
I didn't say things. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I didn't say things that inflamed the police. I said it was the truth that inflamed the police. Not the things that I said, but the truth of what was being said. Because each time there was a disturbance going on in the cities throughout the United States, and there were hundreds of them going on all at the same time, where black people were being shot down in the streets by the police department, being shot down all over the country simply because we wanted to vote, simply because we wanted to go to school and be treated equally, simply because we no longer wanted to be segregated, riding on the back of buses and not being able to eat here, sleep here, and work here. We wanted that to be stopped. And the police, the security, internal security forces of the United States did not wish that to happen. And that is why the hometown of Paterson, New Jersey was able to get rid of me on this flimsy false indictment.
I think also, Terry, it's important to remember what Reuben was doing professionally at the time. He wasn't just a prize fighter, but he had developed this whole persona of the hurricane. He was bald. He had this thick goatee. He would come into the ring scowling, and he looked menacing. Reuben scared people, particularly white people, and he was very outspoken that blacks should use whatever means necessary, including violence, to defend themselves.
Against violence.
Against violence. And as a result, you know, Reuben was under surveillance even before he was arrested for these murders, and Reuben is correct that he was a target, in part because just of the climate of the times, and in part because of who Reuben was.
Reuben Carter, even though you maintained your innocence and fought for appeals and an overturn throughout your years in prison, you didn't try to just accept the prison rules that were handed to you and be compliant with them in the hopes of proving a model prisoner.
I felt as though, and I don't mean to cut you off, but when you say something, it kind of sort of triggers something, you know?
Yeah.
You said model and didn't become a model prisoner. Well, I didn't see why I would become a good prisoner when I hadn't been a bad civilian. That didn't make any sense to me at all. And therefore, I refused to accept someone's imposition of guilt. I refused to accept the government of the United States laws that black people are not human. I refused to accept that, even though the law of the land is that black people are only 4/5 of a human being. That's what the law of the United States is. I refused to accept that, too. You see what I mean? Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. So I was going to say, what were some of the prison rules that you refused to go along with?
Every single one. Every one. I would not. You see, if you had a pie that you baked and you sliced that pie and you find that one part of that pie is poison, then that entire pie is also poison because it's all made out of the same ingredients. And therefore, to walk into that prison and to accept, adopt, or to go along with any of its rules, any of them at all, would be to accept the prison system, would be to accept the mantle of guilt that was wrongfully imposed upon you. You see, a lot of people in prison today standing on the wrong side of the law, not because they went astray, but because the law, having been placed in the wrong hands, strayed from the right path. And that's exactly what happened in this case. It was the law.
So, go ahead.
Rubin turned on its head the traditional relationship between inmate and prison. Normally, a prisoner is able to reduce his sentence time or get parole through some combination of rehabilitation and good works in prison. Well, Rubin refused to go through that process because in his mind, he was not a criminal. And so he refused to wear prison clothes. He refused to eat prison food. He refused to do prison jobs. And as Rubin said, "I will not help my keepers keep me kept." And also, he refused to see the prison psychiatrist who had to, in effect, tell the warden that the inmates had been rehabilitated in order to receive parole. In a way, this was a high-risk strategy for Rubin because if the conviction was never overturned, he stood no chance of ever winning his freedom, but it also showed that Rubin was a man of principle. He would only win his freedom the right way, not in any way that would suggest he agreed with the prison sentence to begin with.
But Rubin Carter, weren't you punished for refusing to play by the rules and even sent to solitary?
Well, solitary confinement was the punishment from day one, because since I would not relinquish my civilian clothes or jewelry or shave my beard or become a non-person, a number, a thing, then they had to get me out of the sight of the rest of the prisoners. So they put me in solitary confinement. And solitary confinement in Trenton State Prison, one of the worst prisons on the whole planet Earth, solitary confinement was under the ground in total darkness, no running water, no sanitary conditions, nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's where they put people to break them. They place human beings in those conditions to subdue them, to destroy them. And that's what's going on throughout these prisons in the United States today. They are destroying people, and they are proliferating unchecked.
So how come your stays in solitary didn't make you think, well, maybe I should start obeying the rules because this is just too horrible to endure?
I am not a criminal. I do not capitulate with criminals. I could not do that. Simple as that. Could not do it.
So how long?
And that's why there's so much crime proliferating in our communities all around it. Because we will not stand up to it. And we will not hold accountable those people who are committing those crimes. Because what is sending an innocent person, what else is sending an innocent person to prison if not kidnapping?
How long were you in solitary confinement?
More time than I care to remember. Years and years, intermittently broken up from time to time.
Well, part of the reality of solitary confinement is that there is no time. There is no schedule. It's not, you see the sunrise and the sunset. As Rubin said, under the ground. So it's very hard for Rubin to know exactly how many weeks or months he was actually down there.
My guests are Rubin Hurricane Carter and his biographer, James Hirsch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rubin Hurricane Carter and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Carter. James Hirsch, can I ask you to just kind of sum up for us the steps along the way to the final overturning of the charges, how many appeals there were and so on?
Sure. Well, of course, Rubin's first conviction was overturned in 1976 by the state Supreme Court, which ruled that he had been wrongfully convicted based upon withholding of material evidence. Rubin was then retried and reconvicted a second time. And Rubin spent 9 more years in prison until finally in 1985, a federal judge overturned the second conviction based upon, once again, the prosecutor's withholding material evidence and also prosecutors making an unconstitutional appeal to racial prejudice.
Rubin Carter, you were released for about 8 or 9 months after your decision was overturned before you were reconvicted.
In 1976, yes.
Yeah, and then when you returned to prison after
yes.
that brief stay outside, It sounds like you changed a little bit. You gave up law books for for philosophy books and spiritual books. What was that change?
That change was because for the first 10 years that I was in prison, I dedicated myself to writing my autobiography, and so our story, the real story, will be told from our point of view, because when we went to court, there was no search for truth there. There was just a game. It was and the prosecutor and the defense attorneys and the lawyers, they were all just playing games there. And so I was determined to get my story out. So for the first 10 years, I wrote my autobiography as well as studied the law and practiced law in the courts of the state of New Jersey. And after that, and I was able, with the help of a lot of people, I was able to have the trial overturned, the conviction overturned, and get a retrial. Well, after the retrial, I saw that I was back in prison and the law would not do me any good. So I gave away all my law books and said, I got to find something beyond the law, find something above the law, something that could control the law. I cannot control the law, obviously. So I got to, because the law, it is the law or the people whose hands the law was placed in that were my enemies. So I had to find something above them, something above them. And that's when we begin to turn the prison into an unnatural laboratory of the human spirit. That's when we begin to search for self, search for myself, search for something above the truth, something that can bring the truth under control.
What books did you find?
Oh, there were many books. I mean, we could sit here and talk about books all day. We're talking about Krishnamurti. We're talking about Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha. We're talking about Uspensky, Gurdjieff, just on and on. Those kind of books, metaphysical books, spiritual books. I studied every religion on the face of the earth, every culture on the face of the earth, every language on the face of the earth. I was trying to find something that everybody always talked about, this great thing that everybody was always talking about. There had to be a shred of truth somewhere behind it. And I was so determined to survive that prison system and bear witness to it that I had to find something beyond myself. And that search was a miraculous search. And that's the search that Jim Hurst's book talks about. What, the miraculous journey of Reuben Carter. Yes.
What about now? Do you consider yourself to be practicing any religion or spiritual discipline? Do you still read that kind of book?
No, I don't. I don't, as a matter of fact. But I do not have a religion. And it all depends on what one understands by religion. To me, religion is a religious mind, a mind that is awake and not asleep, a mind that is conscious and not unconscious, a mind that respects life to the ultimate, a mind, a body, and a soul that comes into agreement with the continuation of life on earth and in total disagreement with the destruction of life on earth. And we're not talking about the entities in which contains that life. We're talking about life, period.
James Hirsch, can you tell us a little bit more about the decision of the federal judge in 1985 who overturned the charges, overturned the conviction against Reuben Carter? What were the main things he cited in his decision?
Well, first of all, it should be noted that the judge, H. Lee Sarakin, received what's known as a writ of habeas corpus. Very few writs are granted by federal judges. It requires a federal judge to evaluate a state court conviction and overturn it. About 3% of those applications are granted because federal judges are far more inclined to rubber stamp the status quo than overturn the conviction. Reuben's case was particularly problematic because it was such a complicated case. The legal proceedings had gone on for almost 20 years at that point, and the motion itself had an appendix of 20,000 pages. Rubin and his lawyers were fearful that no judge would actually sit down and read the case and untangle it. Fortunately, just by the luck of the draw, they did get Judge H. Lee Sarokin, who was known as an outspoken liberal judge who was very sympathetic towards civil rights issues. And so Sarokin was willing to read the case, and once he did, he saw not only were the convictions wrongful, because as I said a moment ago, because evidence had been withheld, and because the prosecutors made an appeal to racial prejudice, but he actually saw the facts of the case and that they did not support the conclusion of guilt. A judge is not supposed to rule on the innocence or guilt of the defendant, just whether the conviction was lawful. But Sarokin saw that not only was the conviction unlawful, but that Rubin was also innocent.
Rubin Hurricane Carter and his biographer James Hirsch will be back in the second half of the show. Here's the Bob Dylan recording that helped publicize Carter's case in the mid-70s when he was in prison. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Shots ring out in a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the upper hall. She sees a bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but what? Champion of the world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Rubin Hurricane Carter and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Carter. Carter was arrested for a triple murder in 1966 when he was a top contender for the middleweight boxing crown. He was convicted and sentenced to life, but continued to maintain his innocence. Let's pick up where we left off. James Hirsch was describing why in 1985, federal judge H. Lee Sarokin overturned Carter's second conviction.
The most controversial part of the second trial was when the prosecutors asserted a racial revenge motive. The prosecutors alleged that Rubin committed this crime to retaliate for a murder that occurred earlier that night in Patterson, in which a white man had shot a black man. And according to the prosecutor's theory, Rubin and John Artis, two black men, shot four white people to retaliate for that. But the problem was that the prosecutors did not show that Rubin and John wanted to retaliate. There was no evidence showing that they were angry, that they were urging other people to retaliate, that other people were urging them to retaliate. Instead, what the prosecutors told the jurors was that this first shooting occurred. There were black people in Patterson, not Rubin and John, but there were black people in Patterson who were angry. Therefore, jurors could infer that Rubin and John were also angry and also wanted to commit a murder. And it was the prosecutor saying that, you know, blacks don't act as individuals, but they act as a group. If all blacks feel one way, then Rubin and John felt that way. And the prosecutors were allowed to use that statement in the trial. And when Judge Sarokin saw it, he said no. He said, unless you can show that Carter and Artis wanted to retaliate, you cannot introduce that motive.
Let's talk a little bit about someone who ended up being a key figure in your story, Rubin Carter. I'm thinking of Lester Martin, and he was he was a young man who'd grown up in a poor neighborhood in Brooklyn, and then
not a poor neighborhood. Let's call it like it is. He grew up in a ghetto.
Okay.
In a ghetto, in a depressed neighborhood with looked like bombed out buildings and rubble spilling out over the sidewalk. Not a poor neighborhood, a depressed neighborhood in the world's wealthiest nation. That's what he grew up in. Just as a lot of other people in this country are growing up in those very same conditions as Lesra and are as illiterate as Lesra was then, they are now.
Now, Lesra met a couple of people from a commune in Canada who ended up being very key to your release from prison. Tell us just a little bit about how they met.
Yes, I will. Lesra Martin was one of seven children born to Elmer and Earl Martin in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, New York City. Well, Earl Martin at one point was the lead singer of the doo-wop trio who sang Come, Come, Go With Me. You remember that song?
That's the Del Vikings.
Del Vikings, that's it. He was the lead singer of the Del Vikings.
You're kidding. But I didn't know that.
Yes, but he had fallen on hard times and was under in public assistance, you know, welfare or whatever you call those in, things in the States. And so Lesra Martin at the time was going to school every single day, stood third in his grade 10 Brooklyn class of 40. Third, he was considered to be an honor student. And so he was also working at the EPA lab in the summertime for those summer make-work jobs, you know? And he met this group of Canadians from Toronto who were in the United States in order to perfect a gas-saving device at the EPA lab. And that's where Lesra was working. Well, these Canadians became very attracted to Lesra because, you know, a little ghetto urchin who was very funny, humorous, and nice, and very helpful to the Canadians. And they listened to this young boy's dreams. Lesra was 15 years old at the time. Listened to his dreams and his aspirations and understood that Lesra wanted to be a lawyer when he grew up. Although Lesra didn't know what lawyers did. All he knew was that lawyers made a great deal of money when people were in trouble. Beg your pardon?
So they kind of adopted him.
Well, before all of that happened, as I was saying, his dream was to be a lawyer. So they went to his mother and father, asked them if they could bring him home, because they realized that although he was third in his grade 10 Brooklyn class of 40, that he was completely and utterly illiterate. He couldn't read or write. He couldn't speak a single word of standard English. In fact, he didn't even know the name of the country he lived in. And these people realized that he will never realize his dream under the circumstances. So they went to his family, asked his family if they could help him. His family was very glad that one of their siblings would escape the ghettos of the of New York. And they took him to Canada and began to tutor him and began to teach him about his own rich African culture. Heritage, teaching him, giving him Richard Wright to read, and Dubois, and Franklin, and Frederick Douglass, giving him all those books. And in doing that, they happened upon my autobiography, in which I wrote in the prison, The 16th Round. And he read that book, and he responded to that book in the same manner in which I wrote it. When I wrote The 16th Round, I figured I was putting a letter in a bottle, throwing it out over those 40-foot walls into the ocean of life, hoping that somebody would see this bobbin bottle bobbing on the ocean of life, pick it up, open it up, read the message, and come to rescue me. And that's exactly what Lesra Martin did.
After you started communicating with Lesra, the commune that had adopted him.
Why do you call it a commune? It is not a commune. It is not a commune. It is people who decided to live together in order to produce, in order to bring their money together to create a business.
In answer to your question, I call it a commune because I believe that's what it's called in the new book about you.
Well, do you believe everything you read?
Well, it's your authorized biography, so the answer in this
case
was, I thought
commune,
I could accept
commune,
the language
commune,
in it.
These are people, human beings.
I knew that.
That's what they are. And any time we put a name to cover a human being, we are calling that human being out of their name.
Thank you. Anyways, so you don't want me to call the group of people part of a commune.
Well,
So,
do you live with your family?
Let's move on.
No, let's not do that. Do you live with your family, your husband,
Ruben,
your wife,
let me start
your
by
children?
Saying I used to live in a commune. So to me, this is not a derogatory word. I don't use that as a way of insulting
the people. Well, let's use people. Then let's use people.
Okay.
That's better because that's what they are. Let's use people, a group of people. There were 13 of us. There was a whole big group of people. So let's say people, not commune.
Okay.
People. Commune has a negative connotation. We talk about the Branch Davidian. We talk about Jim Jones. We look at commune in those contexts. Let's not do that.
Okay.
These are just people.
The group of people who had virtually adopted Lesra eventually adopted your cause, and several of them even moved to New Jersey to be near you. They helped give you things that would improve the quality of your life in prison, from television to better food that they would bring. And they also, of course, took up the cause of your appeal and were instrumental in the appeal process. And you became very close to the people in this group. And when you got out of prison, eventually moved in with them in the group house that they lived in. But that life apparently didn't work out very well for you. What didn't work for you about living with a group and following the kind of principles or rules that guided the group?
There was nothing. There was nothing at all. You see, I love the commitment that these people brought to me. I love everything. These people are the highest people on the planet Earth. I mean, they are the highest level of people that exist on the planet Earth, morally, integrally, as well as intelligently, the highest level that exists on Earth. You see, I love them. I love you. You love your mother. You love your father. You love your sister. You love your brother. You don't live with them for the rest of your life. You move on. That's all. And that's the only thing that happened. You just move on.
My guests are Reuben Hurricane Carter and his biographer, James Hirsch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Reuben Hurricane Carter and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Carter. James Hirsch, in your new biography of Reuben Carter, you kind of describe this group that you just kind of describe his experience of living with this group of people as being in a different form of prison. What led you to that conclusion?
Yeah, well, Chris, you know, Reuben is never going to say anything negative about the group because they did help save his life. But it was a very difficult living arrangement for Reuben because they were a very insular group. And basically, once you lived in the house, you had to be in the house. There was really no outside of the house. And friends of Reuben's told him that this was not good for Reuben, that he had changed one prison for another, and that he had to make his own way.
Jim, let me jump in here.
As Reuben likes to say, he said that live in the house, you have to learn to be helpless. You had to learn to be dependent on the house, and that simply wasn't Reuben's personality.
Jim,
and so he finally went on his own way.
Let me get in here for a second. And let me explain something to you. Let me explain me. And let me explain to you what my life is and has always been and will always be. I have always been the captain of my own ship. Always. And I never relinquished captaincy to anyone, ever. In prison, I was the captain of my own ship. The ship was dry docked. But I was the captain of it, nevertheless. It was my ship, and I was captain of it. And when we finally, with this group, with the help of these Canadians, when we were finally able to win our freedom from prison, well, then I said, okay, I will get off of my ship, and I will tie my ship to the back of the Canadian ship, and I will join them as a crew member. And that's exactly what I did, because I needed that type of support getting out of a prison for 20 years, that living in violence, living in humiliation, living at the lowest level of human existence that one can live in without being dead for 20 years. I needed a halfway house. I needed a place that would tenderize me. I needed a place where I could be without having to struggle and get back into the rat race so quickly. But at the same time, I was always determined that anybody who comes to help me will never leave me any worse off than they were when they found me. And from the moment that I was released from prison on November the 8th, 1985, living with these Canadians, living under their rules in which they established long before I got involved with this thing, and everybody was there for with their own understanding. And so I lived in their house, and everything that belongs to the house belongs to the house. We have a communal pot. That's what we have, a community pot. Everything goes into the community pot. So everything that was generated from me from November 8th, 1985, speaking engagements, books, movies, everything that went into the community pot and did not go to me personally. And when I was satisfied, after the figure reached almost $2 million, when I was satisfied that I had paid back my obligation, the financial obligation that I had to these people, I said, okay, debt's paid. I love you. I'm moving on. And I got back. I resigned my crewmanship from their ship, got back on my own ship, and sailed my ship away. And sometimes my ship was on rocky waters. Sometimes it was in calm waters. Sometimes again it was dry dock. But it was always my ship. And I sailed that ship from the time that I left them 6-7 years ago to where I am at this point as we speak. That is the sum total of it all. And that should put all the controversy to rest. Because if this is a new millennium and we want this millennium to be better than the old millennium, then we got to leave all this stuff in the old millennium and move on with this new millennium.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Reuben Carter and the author of a new biography about him, James Hirsch. Earlier in your life, you were really into flash. I mean, you even had an Eldorado convertible with your name engraved in silver.
Custom made.
And your name engraved in silver on the headlights.
Yeah.
Are you still into that kind of flash now?
No, that was just pure hedonistic arrogance. That's all it was. All I was a neon sign with a chip on his back, daring you to touch it, daring anybody to touch it. No. I think I created, that myth. I created that look when nobody was walking around bald-headed, only old men or something like that. And there I was, a young, vibrant, strapping guy with this bald head and this Fu Manchu mustache. And Sonny Liston and I were in competition to see who could look the meanest. I mean, I was a sight to behold. And no wonder I ended up in prison.
Reuben Hurricane Carter and James Hirsch, the author of a new biography called Hurricane. Before we hear from rock critic Ken Tucker, we're going to take a moment to remember songwriter Bernice Petcare, who died Friday at the age of 98. Her name probably won't ring a bell, but a couple of her songs might, Lullaby of the Leaves and Close Your Eyes. She got her start as a child performer in vaudeville and started writing music in the 1920s. She became one of the few successful women songwriters of her generation. Here's Tony Bennett's 1961 recording of Close Your Eyes, words and music, written by Bernice Petcare in 1933.
Close your eyes, rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes, and I will close mine. Close your eyes, let's pretend that we're both counting sheep. Close your eyes, this is divine music.
something dreamy for dancing while we're here romancing. It's love's holiday, and love will be our guide. Close your eyes. When you open them, dear, I'll be near by your side. So won't you close your eyes? While we're here romancing, it's love's holiday, and love will be our guide. Close your eyes. When you open them, dear, I'll be near by your side. So won't you close your eyes? So won't you close your eyes?
Tony Bennett singing Close Your Eyes, a song by Bernice Petcare, who died Friday at the age of 98. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Michael Hurley. This is Fresh Air.